1993 in order to sell his own polyphase motors, which were clear patent infringements on the Tesla system. This position was supported by the courts a few years later, and Stanley was forced to purchase the Tesla motors from Westinghouse. To fathom the depth of hostility that existed within the Westinghouse camp against Tesla, one need only read Lewis B. Stillwell's chapter on the history of alternating current, written 40 years after the fact in a text entitled George Westinghouse Commemoration. Edited by Charles Scott, the book was widely distributed by the corporation and reissued in 1985. In the introduction to Stillwell's chapter, it is recounted how Westinghouse brought the Golar-Gibbs system to America, how it was modified and then given practical demonstrations by Stanley, and what has happened since. In 1888 came Schallenberger's brilliant invention of the induction meter. In the same year, Nikola Tesla was granted his United States patents covering the polyphase motor and system. Westinghouse promptly secured the American rights. Tesla came to Pittsburgh to develop his motor. He made vain attempts to adapt it to the existing single-phase 133-cycle circuits. The obvious advantages of direct connection of engines and generators called for a lower frequency. Two were selected as standard, namely 60 cycles for general use and 30 cycles for conversion into direct current. If we analyze the structure of this Stillwell quote, we note that although the topic sentence refers to Schallenberger, the entire paragraph is about Tesla. The word brilliant is used to describe an accidental discovery that a spring reacted to alternating currents, when no adjective is used to describe the inventor of an entire power system. Tesla refers to the same situation in his autobiography. "My system was based on the use of low-frequency currents, and the Westinghouse experts had adopted 133 cycles with the object of securing advantages in transformation, because their Golar-Gibbs system operated at that frequency. They did not want to depart from the standard form of apparatus, and my efforts had to be concentrated upon adapting the motor to their conditions." With 120 power plants set up at 133 cycles per second, one can understand the predicament Tesla was placed in. Since Schallenberger's meter was compatible with the prevailing 133-cycle single circuit, it appeared logical that Tesla's polyphase motor could be made compatible as well. In December 1888, Edison's propaganda battle against Westinghouse peaked when Edison began to allow H.P. Brown, who was not an Edison employee, to come to his Menlo Park laboratory in order to electrocute various animals with AC. A few months earlier, Brown had experimented in electrocuting animals at the School of Mines, a division of Columbia University in New York City. Brown, an electrical engineer who lived on 54th Street, had become upset over the many accidental deaths of his colleagues. He had collected a list of over 80 casualties, and although many of the men died because of DC, Brown decided that AC was the real culprit. Within 2 years, Brown began to manufacture electric chairs for various prisons, which he sold for $1,600. He also planned to get paid to be the executioner. During the summer of 1888, the New York Times reported that he tortured and electrocuted a dog, first trying continuous currents at a force of 300 volts. When the shock came, the dog yelped. At 700 volts, he broke his muzzle and nearly freed himself. He was tied again. At 100,000, his body contorted in pain. "We will have less trouble when we try alternating current," Mr. Brown said. It was proposed that he put the dog out of its misery at once. This was done on an alternating current of 300 volts, killing the beast. A number of cities had adopted electrocution to rid the streets of unwanted canines, but the state of New York went a step further and set up a commission in 1886 to report on the most humane method of capital punishment. Under the auspices of the Medico-Legal Society of New York, Brown arose as chief spokesman. William Kemmler, a hooligan who had axed his mistress to death, became the test case for the use of electricity as a means of capital punishment. Ostensibly because the Westinghouse motors could produce the more deadly frequency, Brown surreptitiously purchased some working models in order to continue his gruesome experiments. Naturally, Westinghouse was upset over the devastating publicity. He and Tesla faced the possibility that the new AC polyphase system might never succeed in competition with existing AC and DC technologies, as both former systems required much lower voltages. As Brown prepared to experiment with larger animals in order to assure the commission that electricity could kill criminals in a humane way, the Kemmler trial proceeded to question various electrical experts on the use of the Westinghouse currents for the electric chair. Edison saw the controversy as a slick way to capitalize on the campaign against Westinghouse and the new Tesla technology. Edison's scheme for electrical execution of criminals is the best so far presented. He proposes to manacle the wrists with chain connections, place the culprit's hands in a jar of water diluted with caustic potash and connected therein to 1,000 volts of alternating current. Place the black cap on the condemned and at a proper time close the circuit. The shock passes through both arms, the heart, and the base of the brain, and death is instantaneous and painless. Able to fuel his vendetta, Edison provided access to his famous laboratory for Brown to Westinghouse 24 dogs, which he purchased from the local children at 25 cents apiece. Edison also Westinghoused 2 calves and a horse. Perturbed, George Westinghouse wrote a letter of appeal to the New York Times, which stated that AC was no more dangerous than DC, since people have been shocked and injured by DC as well. Westinghouse assured the public of the safety of his system, so Brown, also in the Times, challenged Westinghouse a few days later to meet me in the presence of the competent electrical experts and take through his body the alternating current while I take through mine a continuous current. The AG must have not less than 300 alternations per second. On July the 23rd, 1889, Edison was questioned under oath by Kemmler's attorney, W. Burke Cochrane, an Irish immigrant schooled in France, in his second term in the House of Representatives. Having gained a reputation locally for fighting Tammany Hall, Cochrane had also achieved national recognition as the boy orator for taking on William Jennings Bryan's presidential opponent, William McKinley, in well-covered debates. Now he set his sights on tackling the Wizard of Menlo Park. Question: has Harold P. Brown any connection with yourself or the Edison Company? Edison: not that I know of. Question: what would happen in case Kemmler should be kept on the chair several minutes with the current working on him? Would he be carbonized? Edison: no, he would be mummyized. Question: this is your belief, not from knowledge. Edison: from belief. I never killed anybody. Finally, Mr. Cochrane alluded to the rivalry between the Edison and the Westinghouse companies and asked Mr. Edison if he loved Mr. Westinghouse as a brother. There was more than usual stillness, followed by Edison's answer: I think Mr. Westinghouse is a very able man. Mr. Cochrane gave the wizard a light from his cigar stump he'd been chewing and dismissed him. It would be another full year before the actual execution took place, but public opinion continued to run against the dangerous Westinghouse current. Although Edison did not author the electric chair ideas, he did everything he could to help the cause, providing his staff, especially the ingenious A.E. Kennelly, later a professor at Harvard, to aid Brown. In addition, he lent his name. Outcries began to appear in various periodicals concerning the electrical executioners. For example, the following editorial was published in a number of the papers and journals: it is hard to conceive of a more horrible experiment than that which will be made on Kemmler. In a secret place, he will be compelled to go through a process of mental and moral, if not also bodily, torture, and nobody can tell how long it will last. This ominous passage actually was not severe enough, for the execution of Kemmler became a nightmare. The job was completely bungled when, after electrocution, to the horror of all present, the chest began to heave, foam issued from the mouth, and the man gave every evidence of reviving. The execution was likened to the work of barbarians and torturers, and to scenes worthy of the darkest chambers of the Inquisition of the 16th century. One eyewitness, who was completely disgusted, was Dr. Jenkins, who told the New York Times, "I would rather see 10 hangings than one such execution as this." Top electricians were also interviewed. "I do not care to talk about it," Westinghouse said. "It was a brutal affair. They could have done better with an axe." Even Edison was affected. "I have merely glanced over an account of Kemmler's death," he said, "and it's not pleasant reading. One mistake, in my opinion, was in leaving everything to the doctors. In the first place, the hair on Kemmler's head was non-conductive. Then the top of the head, I do not believe a good place to give a shock. The better way is to place the hands in a jar of water, and to let the current be turned on there. I think when the next man is placed in the chair to suffer the death penalty, the death will be accomplished instantly and without the scenes at Auburn today." Although Westinghouse tried to distance himself from the nefarious deeds, his company still suffered greater damage than Edison's from a publicity standpoint because it was AC that was used to electrocute Kemmler. Mass hysteria threatened to overpower the attempt to institute the new Tesla AC invention, let alone the prevailing Golar-Gibbs AC system. Tesla realized that eventually the company would have to come around to the lower frequencies if they wanted to use his creation. But to his shock, in 1890, the induction motor work was abandoned. Westinghouse let it be known that his hands were tied, that his backers would not continue throwing tens of thousands of dollars away on futile research. They had given Tesla a fair chance to alter his equipment to satisfy the needs of the company. It seemed folly to destroy all prevailing equipment to satisfy the untried requirements of this new technology. Furthermore, they were against the idea of paying royalties should the motor eventually prove profitable. Enough was enough. In a quandary, Tesla negotiated with Westinghouse a compromise solution. He would abandon the royalty clause of the contract if Westinghouse promised to commit his workers once again to the invention. Westinghouse was in a corner. He knew that he had to curtail all work on the motor at this time to satisfy the tide of hostility that was rising against Tesla. He also realized that the invention was too important, and he believed that eventually a solution would be found. No one knows for sure exactly what happened, but it appears that Westinghouse made a tacit commitment to Tesla that he would get the company to resume work on the motor if Tesla removed the $2.50 per watt royalty clause in the contract. If the motor came on the market and the polyphase system was adopted, the yearly figures cited just a moment ago as payments against royalties, worth approximately $255,000, would be honored instead. Tesla was aware of the historical importance of his invention. He realized that it would alter the world beneficially in measurable ways. His motor, for instance, would provide an inexpensive replacement for potentially hundreds of thousands of hours of manual labor. At the same time, his creation would carve his name deep into the history books alongside such heroes as Archimedes and Faraday. Moreover, he knew that his system was the most efficient, that it was fundamental, and that, if adopted, it would prevail. He also wanted very much to resume his preferred path of pioneer inventor. Tesla was not counting out debits and credits on a balance sheet. Rather, he viewed his partnership with Westinghouse in a more flexible way. He was also negotiating in good faith and assumed that if he lightened the potential financial burden, the company would somehow reciprocate. By offering goodwill, he was hoping to reap what he had sown. Speaking of Westinghouse many years later, Tesla said, "George Westinghouse was, in my opinion, the only man on the globe who could take my alternating current system under the circumstances then existing and win the battle against prejudice and money power. He was a pioneer of imposing stature and one of the world's noblemen." This, however, was a public statement. His private feelings were more complex. It is clear from reading through decades of letters to the corporation that Tesla maintained a close relationship with Westinghouse. Yet often there were undercurrents of resentment, due mainly to lack of appreciation by the Westinghouse concern of Tesla's sacrifice and continuing contribution to the company. Tesla was also upset because the full scope of his patents became simplified, and implications arose to suggest that he merely invented an induction motor and not an entire power system. Finally, after nearly 2 years of inactivity, the Westinghouse people resumed their efforts to make the Tesla motor practicable. In 1891, Benjamin Lamb, a portly, easygoing but studious youngster, began to re-examine Tesla's patents and Tesla and Scott's experimental motors. After conversing with Tesla in New York and talking over the matter with Scott, Lamb approached his overseers with a plan to resume work on the motor. Lamb realized that Tesla had exhausted all the possibilities of trying to adapt his motor to the higher frequencies, and that he was forced to return to the low frequencies, insisting on the superiority of his polyphase system. This idea, as stated just now, was rejected, most likely by Schallenberger and Stillwell. Lamb, as the junior engineer, had to proceed carefully. With Scott's aid, he finally obtained permission to take up the work on his own, although there's little doubt that a number of officials opposed the idea. "By this time, the 60-cycle system was coming in quite rapidly," Lamb said, so he suggested this frequency to the staff. Schallenberger lost his temper and talked some plain language to me. No doubt, he said, that there would be no possible way that they would utilize the lower frequencies. This looked pretty serious to me, who as a mere boy in the test room had got into a row with the chief technical authority of the company. I explained my situation to Mr. Schmidt, who simply laughed about it. However, somewhat to my surprise, Mr. Schallenberger always took my part thereafter. This, of course, gave me a larger idea of the man himself, and I have always looked back with the greatest pleasure to my acquaintanceship with such a man. What happened, most likely, is that Schmidt, along with Scott, went behind the scenes and explained to Schallenberger that here was their opportunity to finally make use of the motor without giving any more credit to Tesla. They would simply let it be known that a new and brilliant engineer working at the company had discovered the efficiencies of lower frequencies, and so the credit would go to Lamb. No wonder Schmidt laughed about it. With a way out, Schallenberger reversed himself and patted Lamb on the back, Lamb somewhat naively concluding that he built the first induction motor, which bears any close example to the modern type. "I also designed the great generators for Niagara, which were without precedent. They were marvels of engineering achievement." Having rediscovered what Tesla had suggested all along, Lamb often made it seem as though he were the originator of the idea. Uneducated readers, left with incomplete source materials, of which there are many, were forced to conclude that when it comes to the AC polyphase system, it was that versatile genius B.G. Lamb, who was the pillar of the Westinghouse Company, who made it possible. But people who read Scott carefully knew the truth. Strenuous efforts to adapt the Tesla motor to the prevailing circuit were in vain. The little motor insisted in getting what it wanted, and the mountain came to Mahomet. 7. Bogus Inventors, 1889-90. Keeley has discovered that all sympathetic streams, cerebellic, gravital, magnetic, and electric, are composed of triple flows. This fact, governing all the terrestrial and celestial orders of positive and negative radiation. He has discovered that the range of molecular motion in all quiescent masses is equal to one-third of their diameters, and that all extended range is induced by sound force, set at chords of the thirds which are antagonistic to the combined chords of the mass of the neutral centers that they represent. Who is the greatest genius of our age? Review of Reviews, 1890. Tesla left Pittsburgh in the autumn of 1889 to return to New York and start his second laboratory, now on Grand Street. There he would begin work on high-frequency apparatus, wireless transmission, and theories on the relationship between electromagnetic radiation and light. In particular, the inventor wanted to replicate the findings of the German academician Heinrich Hertz, a student of Hermann Ludwig von Helmholtz's, who had recently published his landmark experiments in wave propagation. Tesla said that his work caused a thrill as had scarcely ever been experienced before. "I was not free at Pittsburgh," he continued. "I was dependent and could not work. When I left that situation, ideas and inventions rushed through my brain like a Niagara. Before he set up shop, the inventor travelled to Paris to attend the Universal Exposition and witness the unveiling of a gargantuan architectural triumph, the Eiffel Tower. Returning to a city filled with fond memories, Tesla could say hello to old friends and tell them how far he had come. There, the budding creator could stop once again at the Louvre to gaze upon the marvels of Raphael, his self-perceived counterpart in the fine arts. Nevertheless, Tesla also had mixed feelings as he was travelling in the shadow of his nemesis, Thomas Edison, who not only attended the fair, but who also provided a one-acre site for displaying his various inventions. In particular, the phonograph created a sensation, and Edison was received as a veritable demigod. While Edison, who was accompanied by his new wife Mina, just 22 years old, lunched with Alexander Eiffel in his apartment at the top of the tower, Tesla met with Professor Wilhelm Birkenes at the fair to witness the beautiful demonstrations of his vibrating diaphragms. A Norwegian physicist from the University of Stockholm, Birkenes had, along with Jules-Henri Poincaré, not only replicated the work of Heinrich Hertz on the propagation of electromagnetic waves through space, they had also, according to Hertz, discovered multiple resonance and had worked out the mathematics of the phenomena. Tesla was able to study Birkenes's oscillator, which provided a variety of electromagnetic waves and a resonator for augmenting them, and also discuss with him theoretical implications concerning the properties of the electromagnetic waves thereby produced. And while the Wizard of Menlo Park met with Louis Pasteur at his laboratory in Paris and received the French Grand Cross of the Legion of Honor for his achievements, Tesla developed one of his most important discoveries, namely that so-called Hertzian waves not only produced transverse oscillations suggested by Birkenes, but also longitudinal vibrations structured much like sound waves. That is to say, waves propagated by alternate compression and expansion of the ether. This conceptualization would come to play a pivotal role in the wireless transmitters Tesla would construct over the next decade. As Tesla packed his bags for a brief visit to see his family, Edison continued on his tour. In Italy, he was honored by Queen Margherita of Venice and King Humbert of Rome. In Berlin, he met with Helmholtz at his laboratory, and at Heidelberg, Edison displayed his phonograph before a monster meeting of 15,000 people, at which the machine delivered a speech in good German. Edison's favorite moment, however, was when he attended a large dinner given by Buffalo Bill, who was touring Europe with his Wild West show. And as Tesla left for New York, Edison continued on to London, where he could visit his central stations, but also learn firsthand that the new use of the Tesla AC was here to stay. In Deptford, for instance, in this year, an engineer by the name of Ferranti installed probably the first ever working single-phase generating station. With a Tesla system, he was able to transmit 11,000 volts 7 miles away to London. Although a truly epoch-making achievement, this plant, for some unknown reason, received virtually no publicity. This was a complex time in the history of the electrical industry. Those electrical experts in Europe and America who took the time to study the Tesla creation saw its benefits immediately. In Switzerland and Germany, polyphase induction motors were being constructed by C.E.L. Brown, Emil von Doliver Dobrovolsky, and in America, Elihu Thompson of Thompson Houston and William Stanley did the same. As in any branch of science, it was customary to study and replicate the work of others, but in electrical engineering, success ensured not only a place in history, but also a substantial profit. Thus, there would be many, such as most of those mentioned above, who would try and claim the polyphase system as their own. There was another motor invention, however, called the hydropneumatic pulsating vacuo engine, which was on much safer ground. Nobody could replicate the intricacies of its machinery, and nobody but the inventor, John Ernst Worrell Keeley, knew how it worked. Keeley had gotten the idea for the motor after reading the treatise Harmonies of Tones and Colors Developed by Evolution by Charles Darwin's niece, Mrs. F.J. Hughes, which discussed the structure of the ether and various theoretical harmonic laws of the universe. Hailed as a virtual perpetual motion machine, the Keeley motor never ceased to intoxicate the public, for Keeley had the uncanny ability to keep the secret going, but continually achieve abstruse results. In the opinion of Madame Blavatsky, Keeley had discovered Vril, the mysterious force of the universe in which Lord Lytton drew attention in his coming race. Keeley calls it sympathetic negative attraction. Rivaling snake oil salesman in the ability to humbug the public, Keeley, a former circus sleight-of-hand performer, had formed a company in 1874, capitalized with $100,000 of stock in order to sell his motor, and had been successfully doing so for nearly 15 years until 1889, when his work was questioned. Public opinion wrote that engineers, scientific men, and capitalists made frequent pilgrimages to Keeley's Philadelphia laboratory to see the Keeley motor moat. Sometimes it moted, and sometimes it didn't, but Keeley always had a great tale to tell. Keeley's chief accomplishment was a ready use of jargon of scientific and unscientific terms. He talked about triune currents of polar flow of force, the reflex action of gravity, chords of mass, sympathetic outreaches of distance, dipolar etheric waves, and a lot of other things which didn't mean anything. But he never told why his motor moted, and why he never took a patent, although he did have them drawn up. T. Carpenter Smith, writing in Engineering magazine, described an eyewitness account with the inventor at work. "Mr. Keeley proceeded to produce the force by striking a large tuning fork with a fiddle bow and then touching the generator with the fork. After two or three attempts, which he said failed by reason of not getting the cord of the mass, he turned a small valve on top of the generator. When a slight hiss was heard, loud cheers greeted his announcement that he had got it. The state of mind of the audience may be imagined when the shout of one enthusiast, 'Keeley, you are next to God Almighty,' seemed only a natural expression." This mountebank inventor headlined the New York dailies with his newest creations, and also the accompanying cry of fraud. Factions of the public demanded he be jailed, the court giving Keeley 60 days to divulge his secret. But Keeley held fast. Threatening to stop work on his inventions unless the court dropped its suit, Keeley was held in contempt of court, and in November of 1888 he was placed in jail. Shortly thereafter, through his counsel, Keeley revealed that the missing link was a copper tube in the form of a hoop, and he was released on bail a few days later. He argued that he had indeed obeyed all orders of the court in explaining his invention in detail, and the suit against him was overturned. Like Edison, who promised and gave the world the lamp of Aladdin, and Tesla, who discovered and harnessed a purported alternating current perpetual motion machine, Keeley billed his own invention as the greatest scientific discovery of the century. Apparently vindicated, Keeley proceeded with his deception. In 1890, the world's celebrity and palmist, Count Louis Amon, better known as Cairo, visited the Keeley lab, and by 1895, John Jacob Astor became an investor. Unfortunately for Tesla, however, like Keeley, he too was gaining a reputation for making outlandish claims. For instance, Tesla said that his system could place 100,000 horsepower on a wire and send it hundreds of miles with almost no loss of power, when the prevailing technology could only send a few hundred volts 1 mile, and in that case, with power dropping off markedly with distance. Never mind that this prognostication came true just a few years later. Tesla's style was that of a visionary, and the claim seemed ridiculous. To the unimaginative, the uninformed, or people who listened only to the opposition, he was little different from Keeley, and so he suffered through guilt by association. As far back as 1884, Scientific American had published an expose on the Keeley motor, speculating that its source of power was a secret chamber of compressed air. This was confirmed in 1898, after Keeley's death, in an investigation of his laboratory conducted by Mrs. Bloomfield Moore's son Clarence. Having waited for his mother, an ardent Keeley admirer, to pass on before he tore the place apart, Moore discovered in the cellar a large tank and a series of pipes leading up through the floor above where the demonstrations took place. Keeley's etheric force was nothing more than compressed air released by the pressure of his foot tapping on a concealed spring valve.